Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Digitally Uploaded podcast. It has been a while since we did one of these. Unfortunately, while I was in Japan, we had tech issues, which kind of prevented the recording of them, but I'm back. So you all get to enjoy my very irritating voice all over again. All right, so we got two people with us this week. I'm a bit outnumbered by our Kiwi mates. Ginny, hello, Ginny, how you doing?
Good, thanks. How are you, Matt?
I'm pretty damn good. I'm back in Australia, but that's, I guess, a downside. But I can do the podcast, which is a plus. We also have with us Matt. Hello, Matt. How are you doing?
Hello. You are outnumbered by Kiwis, and we're going to come and ban all your games.
Yeah, you are. You already managed to do it somehow to Blue Reflection. I don't know how that happened, but it happened.
That was all Australia.
Soft banned. So yeah, if you do happen to be in Australia and wondering why you can't see Blue Reflection anywhere, even though Matt and I are raving about it on Twitter, we don't exactly actually know what's happened to it, but something seems to have, because it's not on the PlayStation Network, it hasn't been released to retail. It might just have been quietly scrapped, unfortunately. Too controversial.
Which is a shame, because it's a really good game, and it's a game that people deserve to play. To be able to play,
people should be forced to play. It should be like a mandatory thing. It should be part of like a reading list for everybody at school. You have to play Blue Reflection because it's art.
It is.
Anyway, we'll be raving about that lots more.
Matt sounds sarcastic when he says that, but it actually is really very artful and very good.
I'm only a couple of hours in because I could only start playing when I got back from Japan. But yeah, I think it's I really do think it's great. And we'll be raving about it a lot more, I suspect, when we're talking about the kind of Games of the Year awards, when we start doing those, because I would be surprised if this one doesn't pick up some, to be honest.
I don't know. There's some other good games that have come out this year.
Like Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2.
And Ghost Recon Wildlands.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'll stop derailing this podcast.
I'm
Tsunamiku music to get things going. Everybody's in a good mood now, so let's talk about games of October. There's a lot of them. So, yeah, this is the start of the month, and we always talk about the games that are coming out through the rest of the month. There is really a lot of them. So just to quickly run through everything that is coming out on PlayStation 4 and Switch, being the two major consoles that we kind of cover, we have Summer Nights 6, which is finally coming out. We've got Middle Earth Shadow of War, if you're into that stuff. We've got Cyber Dimension Neptunia 4 Goddesses Online, which is really good. I've got a review up of that already. We have The Evil Within 2, if you're into crappy horror games. We have Gran Turismo Sport, if you're into, racing games. That one's going to be pretty damn good. No Heroes Allowed VR looks like it's going to be a ball if you've got a PlayStation VR headset. Dungeons 3 is a sequel to a really good, you call it a simulation mixed with RTS and RPG elements. The previous one was really good, so I'm expecting this one to be very good as well. Koei has another game coming out for us in Knights of Azure 2, Bride of the New Moon, which should be good if you enjoyed the first. Then there's also Yomiwari, Midnight Shadows, which is a sequel to a PlayStation Vita horror game that was pretty damn terrifying. This one's also coming out on PlayStation 4 now. And then towards the end of the month, there's also Chaos Child, which should be pretty good. Look at the Switch. We've got, I guess the big one is Mario comes out at the end of the month, Mario Odyssey. That's probably going to be the biggest one that isn't starring Link for Nintendo this year. Fire Emblem Warriors is also out this, and I've been playing the Japanese version, and it is really good. I would go as far as to say it's probably my favorite Warriors game that's licensed. That's certainly something to look forward to if you like that kind of game and or Fire Emblem. Flame in the Flood is a PlayStation 4 game that was really good. That comes out. And then there's also Oxenfree, which I know Matt's a big fan of. That comes out on the Switch this month and is well worth playing. And the year, so Christmas parties and the like are coming up, and there's a bunch of those games too. Jackbox Party Pack 4 comes out on Switch, as well as Spelunker Party, and those should be pretty good if you can get some group people around. So that's kind of a very quick overview to just some of the games that are coming out in October. There's a lot more, and I've probably forgotten some, and I'll probably get people yelling at me for forgetting those. Fill in the blanks, Ginny or Matt, did I miss anything important?
I don't know if it's important per se, but I'm really enjoying the Miss Layton game. So obviously the Professor Layton game, but with playing as Catriel. It's been a mobile game for a while, but it's coming out this month on the 3DS. So it technically is new, and something that you might have missed. Also, Assassin's Creed Egypt. I'm just looking forward to punching stuff off the back of camels. Really keen on that.
I'm kind of hoping that one brings the Assassin's Creed franchise back a bit for me. I haven't been a big fan of the PlayStation 4 Assassin's Creed games as yet. I really like the 3 that was set in America, and 4, actually, if you count Liberation. So those games were really cool back on the PS3, and I'm really hoping that the extra year of development Egypt really helps it. Also, it's got that history mode, which is really cool, and all 4 games being educational as well as entertaining wherever possible.
It does, except that the history mode is an add-on that it doesn't come out until next year.
Oh no.
Yeah. So in my mind, Assassin's Creed Egypt doesn't come out until early next year. When they announced the history mode, I stopped caring about any other part of the game. If you don't want to just run around killing people and knocking things off camels, you can wait until early 2018 and just enjoy some history.
Anything in particular looking forward to this month, Matt?
No. That's a lie. There's lots of things I'm looking forward to. I'm looking forward to Yomiwari Midnight Shadows, which you mentioned is the sequel to that other very good game. I'm looking forward to Chaos Child. That looks really good. And I do vaguely remember when it first came out on Xbox One, I tried to play a demo of the Japanese version. And it just didn't work because my Japanese is not good enough. So I'm looking forward to being able to play that in English and understand what's happening. I am forward to Wolfenstein 2, The New Colossus, despite being a Bethesda game, because as lots of people have pointed out, it's a game about killing Nazis, and that's a good thing.
Yes, that is a good thing. I'm seriously considering making an exception to our blanket ban on covering Bethesda games at DDNet to allow that one because, you know, good message.
Yes.
I am also looking forward to Bad Apple Wars, which is the new game from Automate, the company that behind Hakuoki and Colorex Malice and all those good Otome games. It looks really good.
Vita game.
Yes, they do still exist. I'm sure there are lots, but the entire of October has just kind of slipped out of my mind. If I had a Switch, I'd be really looking forward to Oxenfree because that game is really, really good. Mm. And I don't think it ever came out on Vita or any other handheld. And I think that'll be the best way to play it on a handheld bed under the cover.
To be honest, everything is better played on the Nintendo Switch at the moment. Like there are very few games I would not rather play on the Switch, to be honest.
I agree.
Very quickly turning into a very favorite console of mine. And great. I've been playing Demo a lot. I think we can count Demo as an October release. It came out last week.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, we should.
I really want to put out a little call for Demo because Demo is a very special little rhythm game. Very no frills, very minimalist aesthetic, and it's all just about the music and tapping the screen in time with it, and it gives me the warmer fuzzies. So I really get out there and play Demo and support it because it's beautiful. Lots of piano music too, actually. A lot of rhythm games are all kind of the pop or the rock kind of stuff to kind of make you feel the music. But Demo is more subtle. It's more about headphones and just kind of immersing yourself in piano music is a very special. I come from a piano background in terms of music. I played piano while I was growing up. There hasn't been a game that's really catered to that experience quite like Demo. So,
Demo. Yeah, it's really good. If you liked VOAS, you'll be pleased to know that Demo is from the same sort of family as VOAS, but without the score-gated storyline. I find like in Demo, you don't have to get like an A on 10 special mode songs to find out more about what's happening in the story. So it's a much more relaxing and different musical experience. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, same developer too, we have to say. We should say it's a Taiwanese developer called Rayark made both of those. They're originally mobile games and they're both really good. There's one more Rayark rhythm game out there called Citus, however you want to pronounce it. And I'm really hoping that also gets a Switch port because that's a really good one as well. Very different again, but really good rhythm game.
Yeah, there's also two other games I want to mention that neither of them is new. They're both re-releases, PS4 ports of old games that came out before, but never got a chance to play for some reason or another. So looking forward to finally getting to play them on a console that I enjoy playing. The first one is Dragon's Dogma, Dark Arisen, which I've heard lots of good things about. And that is actually out now on PlayStation 4 and Xbox One. And so I'm looking forward to playing that. And the other one is Raiden 5, Director's Cut, which if you are insane and you enjoy shoot 'em ups, which I have found myself doing a lot more over the last year or so, then that should be a good one.
Speaking of shoot 'em ups, isn't Goichi Suda's one also out on Switch this month? Is that right?
Wait, which one's that?
Persona Mora.
Mora EX.
Is it out on Switch?
I think it's out on Switch this month, is it, or is it November?
I thought it was already out.
The consoles, it was delayed on Switch. Switch is the last one to come in. And I think it's out this month, if not early next month. Either way, that one is, as somebody who's not a big fan of the bullet hell or the shoot 'em up, I still love that one. So I'm really looking forward to that, yeah. Especially, again, on the Switch, because the Switch is the best console for everything at the moment. Yep.
If I had a Switch, I'd also be very much looking forward to Super Mario Odyssey, just because it just looks so, like,
great.
Just weird. And, well, great, and also just completely bonkers.
Yeah, I mean, it should be good. I'm more a Fire Emblem and Dynasty Warriors kind of person. So for me, Fire Emblem Warriors is probably the big one, the big Switch one this week, month. And like I said, I have been playing it on the Japanese version because I bought it the minute it came out over there. And can't follow. My Japanese isn't good enough to follow the story in, you know, any meaningful fashion. But it's really, really good.
You don't need to follow the story. You just need to admire Lin and Camilla.
Oh, Lin comes so late as an unlock. It's just so much work to get up, but it's worth it. It's worth it. She's the best. I love Lin so much. She's so perfect. She's the best. Maybe even better than Mika. No, I better not say that.
Imagine ending on that. Just like.
No, I just want to quickly say, I mean, if you've been seeing if you're active on social media, you've probably seen some people say some very nasty things about Fire Emblem Warriors, or at least share screenshots of pebbles and claim that's the textures of the game. It's actually not, it's a really good looking game, so ignore, they're pretty bad people. And yeah, look forward to Fire Emblem Warriors. It's good.
Mr. King Dice, I'm the gamest in the land. I never play nice, I'm the devil's right-hand man. I can't let you pass, cause you ain't done everything. Bring me those contracts, come on, bring them to the king. If you haven't finished your path, haven't worked assiduously, no, I cannot let you pass. Don't you mess with me. Don't mess with King Dice. Don't mess with me. Don't mess with King Dice. Don't mess with me. I'm Mr. King Dice. He just what I say. The devil has his price. I'll make sure you pay. I don't have time to mess around, and I hope you will agree. Bring me those contracts pronto. Don't you mess with me. Don't mess with King Dice. Don't mess with me. Don't mess with King Dice. Don't mess with me.
Welcome back. Okay, so for the second section of the podcast this week, we thought we might talk about Tokyo Game Show a bit. I know it's happened a couple of weeks ago now, but unfortunately, again, I was in Japan and couldn't record a podcast on it in particular. But, you know, I was there, and I kind of want to talk about it because, yeah, it was a really good show, and I'm keen also to get a sense from the other people in the podcast who unfortunately were not at PDS, although I know both of you would like to be. But, you know, what was the kind of coverage or the vibe that was coming from Tokyo Game Show this year from people who were not actually at the event, you know, who were following along on the socials or the internet and stuff?
I think in terms of the people, at least, that I follow on the internet and interact with, a lot of them that weren't there were quite bummed that they weren't there. but that's probably a small sample size.
My experience
of the main of quote unquote mainstream gaming circle. I feel like people get a lot more butthurt about not going to PAX, for example, than they do about not going to Tokyo Game Show, which I think should be flip flopped. I think Tokyo Game Show is a much more game centric and journalism centric event than PAX. But yeah, I think the consensus was that people that were really into the games and the brands being shown at TGS were quite bummed that they couldn't go, but that would have been a small portion of the mainstream gaming community, which is a bit shitty, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the little bit I was able to see while I was busy, people seem to be a little bit disappointed with what they saw from TGS. Is that fair to say? It was perhaps there wasn't any big announcements, which is usual, I guess, for the show, because it's not really about the big announcements. Mm-hmm. But people seem to think it's like an E3 when it's kind of not. But was there much news that came out of it? Was there much coverage, do you think?
Not at all, actually. Apart from updates from, like people like you and other people that sort of run smaller sites or niche sites that are focused on games and the Japan gaming scene, I really didn't see very much.
Yeah, I guess that's probably the sense I had, but yeah, it's good to confirm that, which is unfortunate because, yeah, it was a really good show. Yeah. Lots of interesting stuff happening, actually.
I didn't see much coverage either, actually.
I guess the thing... One of the things, I guess, is part of the problem is that a lot of the stuff that was really popular at TGS is stuff that probably wasn't going to be very popular with Western critics who might have been there.
That's true. I think, yeah, the main thing I saw on social media and mostly from following Inti Creates social media was photos and videos of people lining up so they could at the Galgun 2 display so that they could get Earth Babes.
Actually, that was a pretty popular booth. Inti Creates did a good one. They actually had a really good spot on the floor, so nice and central. So I think because it was quirky and stuff, they did have quite a few people gravitating there. The thing that impressed me most actually was Konami's booth. Konami's kind of a dead company because Kojima's left and they don't produce any more games and all that kind of nonsense. But they had a huge booth this year and it was very popular.
That was very surprising.
Yeah.
Metal Gear.
Because what games do they have? Do they have? They've got the soccer game, but whatever it's called.
Yeah, so they had Winning 11, as it's called in Japan. It's called, PES out here.
That's right.
Was there? They had the baseball game that they have in Japan, the Japan only the bobblehead baseball game.
Oh, yeah.
Yep, and that was popular. They actually had baseballers there, professional baseballers, Japanese baseballers, and that drew a big crowd as well.
Oh, wow.
Around the back, they had Metal Gear Survive. It wasn't probably as popular as a Metal Gear that Kojima produced might be, but it's certainly on its way. Certainly doing a big effort in it. They were partnered with, I can't even remember the company now, but they're partnered with another Japanese company to... partnered with Falcom to share some booth space. So the Trails of Heroes 3 game was actually on the Konami booth. And then the big one was Love Plus. They've got a game coming for mobile, which has no relevance whatsoever for the West because that series doesn't get localized. But shows in Japan, and I'm talking hours long lineup to try this one on mobile. And the big is VR mode, which is the first time you'll be able to date your Love Plus girls in VR, which you can imagine would go down pretty well with the fans of that series. And it's a really good series. I've played one of them in Japanese before, and for the reputation it has in the West from people who haven't played it, it's not quite what I think people think it is. So that was really impressive. Who else had good booths? Sega had a very big booth because they were showing off Yakuza games as well as Fist of the North Star, which is basically a Yakuza game but with an anime beefhead rather than Yakuza beefhead. Should be good. Really looking forward to that. It's about the same development studio. It looks exactly the same. They put the posters side by side, and I thought they were just two Yakuza games, but no, one was actually Fist of the North Star, and that was actually Kenshiro that they had on the poster. Phoenix had a big booth, but it was split across a couple of different booths because they had a mobile a huge booth for the mobile Final Fantasy 15 game. Huge booth. They had a big booth for Final Fantasy 14 still, and you know that game's been out for however many years now, but the lineup for people to try it was still really long because I think they were showing off some new stuff. Managed to line up for 3 hours and go through it. You got some kind of exclusive Final Fantasy 14 kind of. So I think people are lining up a bit for that as well. Koei had a smaller booth than they've had in years past, but it was a good one. So they had Fire Emblem Warriors on that one. They also were showing off Dynasty Warriors 9, which is incredible looking and plain. I really enjoyed my time with that. Atelier, the girls, the twins. I just think of it as the Twin Fantasy Atelier game, which is cool. And they have... Koei has another development studio that we don't know of much here in the West. It's called Ruby Rose, I think. And they specialize in Otome games, a bit like, we're talking in the last segment of like Bad Apple and Hakuoki and that kind of genre. And they produce quite a lot of games with very pretty men. And you get to date them and stuff. And that's quite a popular developer for Koei in Japan. So that gets a bit of a booth space as well. And again, the Western had that, but it looked interesting.
I do wish they would consider localizing some of those Ruby Party games, because especially after playing Warriors All-Stars, which has a couple of characters from one of them.
Yeah.
I want to play them.
I'm surprised they don't, to be honest.
I
would have thought that they would have looked at the success that Compile Heart and Axis and
Idea Factory,
PP Cube gets from localizing visual novels, and I would have thought they would have at least tried one and just see how it went. But you never know. Maybe one day. They're very busy people in Koei. They do produce a lot of games and localize a lot of games. So,
did you get a chance to look at any of the indie games? Because I think that don't they usually have like an indie section?
They do indeed. TGS? Actually, there's a couple of indie sections. So there's a dedicated spot for indie developers from anywhere in the world to go and set up their booths, and it's right next to the merchandise section. So it's in actually a separate hall to the main games. And the reason they do that is they want the indies to not feel like they're competing with Square Enix and Sega for the attention of people in the hall. And they know that a lot of people are going to come into the merchandise hall anyway to get their, you know, tapestries and clear files and stuff. So yeah, it's quite busy. And quite good, and there was a couple of Aussies there, which was good to see. And one game in particular that really caught my attention, and I can't remember the name of it now. It was a Taiwanese developer making kind of history games about the fairly dark side of Taiwan's history.
I remember hearing about that.
And they use it to kind of promote, you know, the of Taiwan's history and make some very strong and important political points. They were very passionate when they were talking to me. But the way they make it palatable
Are you saying they put games?
They do. They're very political, politically motivated, and they really want to show, you know, how people feel about these kind of these tragic events that have happened in Taiwan's history, because it's a pretty checkered. But yeah, the way they make it palatable to people is they put anime boob girls in, and it's all about. it looks like you know, Dead or Alive, the visual novel. But it tackles some pretty serious stuff. I have to track down the name of it because and they're expanding. They're doing one about a massacre that happened in Indonesia next. They're definitely committed to telling the darker stories here throughout Asian history in a way that, you know, people who like anime boob girls can still enjoy. So I guess that's educational in a way. Indie sections throughout Tokyo Game Show, because I think Tokyo Game Show's main goal at the moment is to really engage with Asia and become kind of the centerpiece for the Asian market, which I think they see as very separate to the Western market now. And I think Japan sees greater opportunities for Japanese game developers in China and Korea and Southeast Asia. So what they do is they invite the developers to come and set up actual national booths. So as I was walking around, there was a massive booth, at least as big as any of the major booths from Sony or Square Enix or whatever. And it was all dedicated to Korean developers. And all the Korean developers came and set up little booths and showed off what they were doing. And it was an opportunity, I guess, for Japanese developers or industry people to go and see what's happening in these markets. Singapore, there was Malaysia, and then they had kind of smaller booths for markets you wouldn't even think had game developers, like Myanmar or Brunei or, you know, Iran. So interesting to go around and just see the kind of the multinational stuff that was going on, stuff we don't see much in the West, stuff that doesn't get covered because there were certainly no Western journalists going through those sections when I was there. And I think that's kind of where the core of Tokyo Game Show is in a real, as an event that's really worth going to, is to see where the Japanese market sees the opportunities and where they see their role as a kind of the leader in the Asian market. Looking to facilitate greater relationships between Asian game developers. And yeah, we're going to see I think the Asian market will see a lot of that. I don't know how much of that will come out of Tokyo Game Show, which is why I kind of recommend people going along and having a look for themselves if they get a chance.
That sounds really interesting. Was there much of a presence for Western publishers? Because I know the one time I've been was the year that Grand Theft Auto 5 came out, and kind of TGS itself was like the week before the release date. And so Rockstar had a huge booth, and the lines for that were lines in the show. Do they still do that kind of stuff now, or is it just very much more?
I mean, in years past they have, when they've had something big to sell. So 2K last year set up a big booth because they had Mafia 3 coming soon. And it was pretty funny because it was set up right opposite Sega's booth that year, and the lineup for Yakuza was 3 or 4 hours long. And the lineup for, you didn't actually have to line up for Mafia 3, you just walked in and played. Yeah, so they didn't set up a booth this year. Actually, there was virtually no Western presence whatsoever, independent publishers at the event. I've been in the past where EA, Activision, but EA, Microsoft, and 2K have all set up have set up booths at times. This year, none of that. There was some Western stuff in kind of the Sega Partners, for example, had a game. I can't remember which. So at the back of the Sega booth, there was a Sega Partners section where they had a couple of games from their Western publishing partners. Square Enix is publishing Evil Within 2 in Japan, and so they had that game on display in their booth, but there was no dedicated Western game developer booths this time, or publishers, which was odd. It shows, I guess, it kind of proves my point where I'm saying that TGS is much more about the Asian market now, and definitely about promoting it, because it was no smaller. The show was huge in terms of the number of booths they had, but the Western presence was very mild. There was a little bit of stuff in the VR and esports area, because I think Japan's grappling with how they can get involved with esports, and they're actually inviting a lot of Western developers and publishers to kind of... So there was a lot of Western stuff in the esports section, but because I can't stand esports, I didn't go in there.
Ouch.
Basically, yeah.
That's quite interesting, actually, that there are people from Iran and Myanmar, countries like that. The PAX schedule for PAX Australia has just come out, and I don't think if we're sort of measuring comparative inclusion of other countries and topics from other countries, TGS seems to have a really well-rounded, you know, sort of thing for a conference called the Tokyo Game Show, which is quite good, actually.
And it's also odd because it's not, I mean, there's huge sections there that are dedicated almost entirely just to business. So, you know, developers go in and localize, they'll meet localizers or they'll have conversations about that stuff. And TGS has that reputation for being a very consumer oriented one because two of the days are dedicated entirely to consumers going along and playing games. I think it surprises people a lot to know just how much stuff happens behind closed doors at TGS, but yeah, a lot of that happens. And again, it's deals done now between kind of Asian countries. And I think that's something that PAX doesn't have. PAX is a purely kind of consumer-facing event. I don't think there's any kind of business stuff that happens at those events. Back everyone. So for the last section this week, we thought we'd talk about the Super Nintendo mini console thingy-ma-diggy that Nintendo released last week. Now, and we've had a chance to let the crushing disappointment of the console sink in. And yeah, it has been. I wrote an article on the website about it. I find it to be quite a disappointing. It has that nostalgia value because it is so cute and it is exactly like the original Super Nintendo in design. And then, of course, there's the initial rush of jumping in and having, you know, 21 classic games to play. A lot of those games are from my childhood. But then you'd start to realize the kind of limitations of the console and the fact that 21 games isn't really enough to actually reflect just how good that console was. So... yeah, I made the purchase and did the review, so you all don't have to do it, I guess. You're welcome. But I guess more seriously, I mean, do either of you see any value in the Super NES Mini, or what do you think it needed before you would have seen value in it?
I don't see much value in it. And to be fair, I didn't see much value in the NES Mini either. I think part of it, and this is coming from someone who Super NES is, I think, one of the best consoles that there has been, just in terms of the sheer range and quality of games that were on it. And I think the Mini just, doesn't do a good job of really capturing or showcasing that. So I get the impression, and this is very understandable, that what Nintendo is trying to do is reach out to kind of people who have fond childhood memories of playing Super NES and then haven't really continued playing games much as they've grown up. And so it's just a way to give them a way to the memories of those games that they played as a kid. Which for me, there are so many other ways to anyway between virtual console or slightly more frowned upon methods. I think there would have been a lot more value in using a console to showcase some of the really good games on some of the really good Super NES games that aren't as well known, because there are so many games that most, for whatever reason, short release runs or not being localized, that people just wouldn't have had a chance to play. But if you actually do get a chance to play them, they're really good games. And so I think there's a huge missed opportunity around that.
Yeah, I kind of agree. And I guess an issue with this one, like I didn't get the NES Mini. I probably would have if, you know, the stock wasn't so short with it when it released last year. But I guess at least the NES Mini was because they needed to release something for Christmas last year, because they had nothing on the Wii U or the 3DS as they were kind of ramping up towards the Switch launch. So they needed something to just prop up the kind of the books for the kind of important Christmas period. So I think people at that stage were so starved for Nintendo stuff that they would have bought anything and kind of loved it. It comes out in a different situation where the Switch is doing really kind of gangbusters, and people, the fact that they've got a Switch and saying to themselves, well, why can't Nintendo just release the Super NES games on the Switch as a kind of virtual console thing? I agree with them there. I kind of wish that there was a virtual console on the Switch instead, and I could get the games that I wanted from the Super NES Mini, because I don't like all of them. And I won't play all 21 of them because I don't like all of them. It would have been good to be able to pick which of those 20 I like and kind of download them onto my Switch. Or alternatively, if they really wanted to make this console thing work, was put some kind of online connectivity there and giving people an eShop to download more of the Super NES games if they wanted to. And that would have given them a chance to explore some of the more niche games that you mentioned there, Matt. So I understand what this product is meant to do beyond just sell copies to people that have fond memories of the Super NES, which is a little bit exploitative, I guess, for me.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat as the both of you. I mean, I loved a lot of these NES games when I was younger, played quite a few of the SNES games when I was younger, but I didn't feel the need to actually buy the SNES Mini. And I mean, I think you were right. Like, I mean, the games I love playing, like, you know, Yoshi's Island, Kirby's Dream Course, stuff like that. Like, I'm happy with the memories that I had. Like, and I'm probably not the target market then for the SNES Mini, but they really did miss a chance to bring the games, to bring some SNES games that weren't available in the West to them now with the SNES Mini. Like, I mean, they could have left on some classics, like the ones that I just mentioned, maybe something like Super Punch-Out, I don't know, Legend of Zelda. Like, you could have left that stuff on, but tried to include a wider roster. But I think even then, it wouldn't have compelled me to actually get the SNES Mini.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it would be hard to create a list of just 20 games and somehow have that reflect everything for everybody on the SNES. I mean, there were so many were released on the SNES. You could have a SNES, you know, mini RPG edition and just fill it with 20 RPGs, which would be just awesome, and that would be a much better console. But a lot of people who don't like RPGs, who like platformers, we would probably not like that one so much. But yeah, it's just with the selection that they have done, there are things missing. Like, if you talk about platformers, where's All Stars, which was the remake of the first three Mario Brothers games? That was a massive hit on the Super NES. Or where's Donkey Kong Country 2 and 3? You've got the first one there, but it's not a complete collection if you don't have the other two. You look at RPGs, there's Final Fantasy VI, but not Final Fantasy IV. So, you know, what are they doing there? And there, like we were saying, there's this big opportunity that they had to bring stuff that people hadn't had a chance to play before, which would have been a real selling point. And they did that with one game, because Star Fox 2 is on the SNES Mini, and that was never released originally. But why didn't they localize some Japan-only games? How good would it have been to actually play the Final Fantasy V, the SNES version, you know, localized into English on a SNES for the first time for us in, you know, Australia. Mm-hmm. That would have been really nice. And they could have done that, but they didn't. That's I guess, my disappointment with that.
I think that if nothing else, I think the one thing that would have sold it for me was if they had put Bahamut Lagoon on it, which I don't know if either of you have ever played that. It was a Squaresoft at the time, tactical RPG, very much in the style of Fire Emblem, but more focused on dragons and with a very deep kind of dragon raising simulation element, and just a really good game overall. And through it's relatively easy to play now, just because there's been a fan translation that's easy to find, but having that released officially in English for the first time would have been, I think that would have been enough to sell me on it. Same, and they'd found to include that.
Yeah, there's a couple. I mean, I would have loved it. It was released in English, I guess, but not in Australia, I don't believe, and it was almost impossible to find anyway. Ogre Battle was a really great RPG. By Quest. Quest was a developer that was subsequently bought by Enix and then Square to be part of the Square Enix group. But Square Enix has kind of let Ogre Battle, the franchise, die. People a chance to experience that game because it's certainly a classic. There's just so many that they could have done. They could have really reached into the archives and pulled some great stuff out. Probably because they wanted, you know, 20 really popular names to stick on the box.
Mm.
But that doesn't kind of, that really doesn't represent what the Super NES was about, I think, for most people. For most people, SNES was the first time that there was a console that really different tastes. Before that, you're kind of stuck with a limited range of games, and they all kind of played the same way, and, you know, the hardware was limited, and, you know, you're a fan of, if you're a fan of games, you played kind of what was put in front of you. But with the SNES, people finally started to have choice about what kind of genres they liked. And there was some experimentation going on about, you know, merging genres or mixing, you know, trying different things. And that, I think, is the thing that is really missing, that they should have tried harder to reflect through this. I guess we're being a little bit harsh on it, given it is a cheap little box that you just stick under the TV, and I don't think it was meant to be a major console release by any means, but it's just disappointing because there's a lot of potential there. I think a lot of people had good memories of the SNES. People like me probably wanted it to be more than it is, fortunately.
Yeah. Mm. I think that that's the point. It's not bad for what it is. I just think it could have been so much more, and that's my frustration with it.
Yeah, I think that's it. Maybe like with the NES Mini, people didn't expect it to be much more because it is such an old console. It's just purely a hit of nostalgia. But the SNES is maybe a little people's hearts of a wider range of ages now. So, yeah. I think the other thing actually is that Atari has one coming, which against all odds actually looks like it might be worth buying. I don't know if have you guys seen that, the Atari mini console that they've...
No, I haven't actually.
Okay, so after the podcast, go and have a look at it because it looks quite neat. It's actually a fully internet connected console, which I think is actually going to support, you know, games that are developed that can kind of fit its specifications and stuff, and it'll have all the old Atari games on it and stuff as well.
Oh, nice.
So really neat. I haven't followed it too closely, I must admit, but I've seen enough of it to know that it's on my radar for when it gets closer to release. And I say that as somebody who wasn't I've never owned an Atari console, but just from the retro appeal of it and what it promises to do in terms of the one of these micro consoles, there's a lot of potential there.